The Nail in the Coffin!
All right, welcome to The Nail in the Coffin. I'm Tom Valentino. He is Travis Yulee. It's Monday night. Trav, how are you, man?
All things considered, buddy, I am doing fantastic. How about you?
Feeling a lot less stressed than I was at this time a week ago, and I'll leave it at that.
Tell me about it. Feeling the best I felt in 4 years.
Yeah, anyway, we are at the midpoint of the Brown season. We finally have Ohio State football, and puts us in a good spot to kick off year number six of the podcast for us. This is our first episode in year
Holy
six.
Holy crap.
Six I know, years. Right?
Jeez, that's insane. That's just, wow. Would not have guessed that craziness.
Yeah. Yeah, so five in the books here. This is the start of number six, and we've been off for a couple of weeks here, just working on some things behind the scenes. If you're listening, you will probably notice some new stuff here and there. And we'll have a lot more to say on that in the coming weeks. Good things for the podcast. We're excited. We'll fill in the details there as we go along. But in the meantime, where do you want to start? Browns, Buckeyes, what do you got?
Let's open with the Browns for now. They had a bye week, but we're right at the midway point of the season. I think a little bit more to talk about, probably.
The Cleveland Browns. All right. 5-3 through the first eight games. Bye week could not have come at a better time. Limping into the finish there with that tough game against the Raiders last weekend. How are you feeling about the Browns? I'm excited and curious myself to see what they look like this coming weekend. It seems like a lot of guys are going to be back. Folks who have been dinged up here in recent weeks, getting a chance to get healthy. Where are you at?
Well, I think it's interesting because obviously when they lost Chubb, I think we watched early on in the season. I think initially when they signed Kareem Hunt, we thought, you know, that'd be a great, you know, if Chubb goes down, he'll fill in really well and we won't miss a beat. I think we noticed the last couple weeks, he's obviously fine. Like, I think Kareem Hunt is fine. There's no problem there. But having him and Chubb is a huge luxury, and having to rely exclusively on Hunt, you lose quite a bit in the running game, which is, to be understood because, you know, Nick Chubb is that good. But I guess watching the Oakland anymore. Watching the Raiders game, I take from it that they seem to struggle quite a bit on offense. And the defense, I've never heard people complain so much about a defense that gave up, 16 points, 13 yeah. points, something like that. But if you watch the game, you totally understand it. It's 100% valid. So I don't know. They're in a weird spot, and I think you put it the right way. I think the bye came at the perfect time. We're all, you know, getting pretty excited, pretty optimistic about where they were. And I think most people around Cleveland kind of looked at that Raiders game like it was a gimme. So it brought them back down to earth a little bit. But all things considered, I think we're going to sort of see what this team's made of in the second half. They've still got a pretty easy schedule. They lost OBJ, and I think people are sort of – I don't want to get into the whole is Baker better without Odell or not, but because I think that's just silly. But I don't know. It's going to be a different sort of looking team, I think, in the second half because they've – you know, I don't know when's the last time we were going into week 10 with something like meaningful games.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. Number one, as far as the defense goes, that Raiders game – for the defense was a classic case of death by a thousand paper cuts. I don't think the Raiders hit any significantly deep plays, which obviously is going to kind of be the case on when you're playing in 35 mile an hour winds. But Browns just could not get off the field. And that's kind of become the story of their last two games. They forced one punt in 2 weeks. I think Oakland, I know, he got me doing it. Vegas had, what was it, five different drives that went for at least 12 plays. I mean, that is just brutal. The Browns only had six possessions in the entire game. As far as the offense goes in the running game, I mean, we know the Browns are going to be based offensively around their ability to run. And yeah, there's obviously been a lot of scrutiny in terms of having Nick Chubb versus not having Nick Chubb. I would also throw into that equation not having Wyatt Teller, because if you look, those two guys, Chubb and Teller, went down in back-to-back weeks. And I was just looking at some numbers today. The Browns, during the first 4 weeks of the year, were averaging over 200 yards a game on the ground. In the last four, it's been under 100. And their running efficiency going to the right side, where Teller would be blocking, has dropped off a cliff. Yards per carry going in that direction is just plummeted. So I think it was Zach Jackson from The Athletic said, Wyatt Teller made himself a lot of money in the first four games of the year, and he made himself even more money not playing the next four.
That's a good point.
Which I would agree with 100%. We'll have a Baker Mayfield conversation in a second, but as far as the running game goes, I think from what I read today, it sounds like Teller should be back. I know Nick Chubb was
returned. Yeah, they returned to practice. Was cleared,
so hopefully having those two guys back will help significantly this weekend.
Yeah, the Teller injury, I think, kind of, I don't know, I feel like people didn't really pay it as much attention as they should have. The thing that's weird, I don't remember who it was, and it was kind of laughable at the time, but the week before he got hurt, I saw someone put together like a top 10 MVP article, and he was number 10, which is laughable, right? It really is, and I'm not even taking it that seriously. But it still shows sort of how improved our line was and how well he was playing. So to the fact that he, you know, went down and it showed pretty much right away. Right. And can you put it all in one guy? Probably not. I think we've seen Jedrick Wills regress a little bit the last couple of weeks, and just generally it's not out. The offensive line isn't operating as well as we had seen it prior. But hopefully getting Teller back solidifies that a little bit more and they get back to how we saw him earlier in the season. And yeah, ultimately we could see the team a little bit more than how it looked earlier in the season, as opposed to, you know, the Raiders game and the Steelers game.
Crazy stat on Nick Chubb. I believe I read that even though he's missed the last four games, he still leads the league in 20 plus yard runs.
Really? That's an interesting stat. What's he have, like three?
I'm guessing more than that. I don't have it in front of me. Professional operation we're running here. let's talk about Baker Mayfield. It's you obviously starting quarterback is going to be the most important position on an NFL team, period. And for just so many reasons this year, you know, especially with where he's at in his rookie contract, this is kind of a big referendum year. So the tide will ebb and flow on what we think of Baker. It feels like week to week, and there's a lot of scrutiny, a lot of pressure on him. I'm not going to pin much of the Raiders game on him. I think the Browns dropped five passes. Not to mention, you know, trying to throw in those 35-mile-an-hour winds. Plus, you know, you were without your best running back, your best offensive lineman, your best wide receiver, and your best tight end. So that's a pretty tough combination of factors all working against him there. If anybody was looking to throw Baker under the bus, I think at least that week...
The Raiders game. Yeah, the Raiders game isn't the one to
that's,
point to.
That's not the one to pin your case on. You know, from the last time that we did an episode, I think I was talking with Andrew from Waiting for Next Year. You know, the two big questions I've had about Baker or about the, well, about the Browns in general. One was about Baker. The Baker question I had was, at some point this year, we're going to have to see, can he lead a game-winning drive in the fourth quarter with the game on the line? Because up to that point in the season, a few weeks ago, he really hadn't been asked to do a whole lot in fourth quarters. And, you know, we got a great response on that in the Cincinnati game, where he had to take the offense down the field in a minute with no timeouts and you know, got it done.
Perfectly, yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And that Cincinnati team, I think, is a little bit friskier than their record would indicate. You know, they came out and beat Tennessee. They've got some weapons. Joe Burrow's been great. That was a fun game, and Baker was a huge reason for that, you know, which was crazy after he started 0-for-5. So, you know, definitely showed us something there. And, you know, the other big question I had at that point was, could the Browns defense be good enough if they're not forcing a bunch of turnovers? Because that was kind of a big storyline in those wins early in the year. You look back to like the Washington game, for example, how many times did they pick off Dwayne Haskins? And, you know, what we've seen these last 2 weeks, you know, they just can't get off the field. I know Jacob Phillips, the linebacker, I think is slated to come back this week. God knows they need some help in their front seven. They just got pushed backwards constantly against the Raiders. So we'll see what happens. I'm not saying one young player like that is going to turn everything around, but anybody and everybody, all hands on deck, you know, to kind of shift things a little bit would be a welcome sight.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like I think the Raiders game is sort of just maddening to watch, right? The numbers aren't real glaring, and the stats for the D that day don't look that bad. But if you watch that game, it's just like they can't, like you said, they can't get off the field. They can't get a stop, like, under any circumstances. It seemed like they had Raiders had two drives in the second half that were more than 8 minutes long.
Right.
That's brutal. And they only got, they got 10 points off of those. And so, you know, they got a field goal and touchdown, and that's not like, that's not crushing. Under normal circumstances, if you give up a field goal and a touchdown in the second half, you're feeling pretty good about it. But the game was just generally so sloppy. And usually you'd think that favors the defense a little bit, right? It's going to be harder for guys to hold on to the ball and stuff like that. And they just didn't make anything happen. They didn't do anything with that. What do you think of their, I'll say, inactivity at the trade deadline? I've seen there were a lot of names that got thrown out there, and I know it's sort of a weird year. Teams were sort of not really sure what the cap's going to look like and stuff like that. So it's generally a bit of an odd sort of situation, but they didn't make any moves. They didn't change anything. We saw some names that got thrown out there that, I don't know, if you're like me, you sound like, hey, that guy would sound pretty good. And, you know, safety or linebacker or someone like that who could fill in and give us, you know, a little more than we're getting. It raises the question, how much are they really paying for or playing for right now? I mean, if you look at this team, they're probably going to make the playoffs with the expanded playoffs, and, you know, they only have to win a few more games and their schedule's relatively easy. So that's in sight, and that's the ultimate target. And if that's the target and you're expecting to make the playoffs, why wouldn't you try to put a team together that could, you know, maybe steal a first round game or something like that? So I don't know. I don't think, looking at the team right now, I don't think anyone's going to tell you with a straight face that they're happy with the defense or happy with the overall, the depth chart on the defensive side. So I don't know. I thought it was a little odd that they didn't do anything. I've heard a lot of people sort of explain it in ways that make sense. Ultimately, you know, just overall the climate, we didn't really see a whole lot of major changes or anything like that anywhere across the league. But I guess I still expected them to do something to try and shore up the defense a little bit.
Yeah, you know, the NFL trade deadline, for whatever reason, it feels like, has just never really been as exciting as what we typically see out of the Major League Baseball trade deadline or the NBA trade deadline. Those two leagues, I think, have a lot of activity right on deadline day. And the NFL, it just does not seem how most front offices operate. I felt like there was an opportunity for the Browns to kind of strengthen some things around the margins. I thought we might see, I was not expecting them to go out and, you know, make whatever the NFL equivalent of trading for an ace pitcher would be. There's not going to be any dramatic swings at this point in the season. But
they could have traded for J.R. Smith. I don't know what the NFL equivalent of J.R. Smith is, but
Maybe they could have got J.R. Smith. Who knows? throw him some fade routes in the corner.
He could go get something, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, I mean, from that perspective, I was a little disappointed, especially when you look at where they were on their schedule in terms of having the deadline come up like early in their bye week. You know, you would have had a perfect opportunity, bring somebody in, get through all the COVID-related protocols, get them comfortable, get them some practices. You could not really ask for a better situation in the middle of the year to implement a new player and get him contributing fairly quickly. So for them to not get something done there, it's kind of a downer. You know, we'll see how it goes. You know, I've heard you a couple times in this discussion mention playoffs in terms of probably going to the playoffs or easy schedule down the stretch. And I want to talk about that because I'm not 100% sure I'm on board.
Well, you're wrong.
Wouldn't be the first time. remaining games. Obviously, we're going to see Houston this week, Philadelphia, and then at Jacksonville. Okay, those are three games. Or the Browns are certainly going to have a very good shot at winning. No such thing as a sure thing, but none of those teams are world beaters.
Houston and Philly have bad records, but I think you look at them and you know that they're both probably better than their records.
Yeah.
So, right. I mean, yeah, they're not gimmies by any means, but they're also
Deshaun Watson's still a player. So
yeah, they're also not like, they're also not, you know, the Chiefs or the,
we're going to see a Romeo Crennel revenge game this weekend. We got to look out. you know, you're looking at December and yeah, you got the back-to-back weeks in the middle of December, in the Meadowlands against both the New York teams, but around that, there's a game with Tennessee who's looking to be a playoff team, Baltimore and Pittsburgh. Now, those two division games are both at home, but those are two teams that the Browns did not exactly fare very well against first time around.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's three games there that I think are going to be real difficult, which would mean to get to 10-6, you would have to go 5-0 in those other games that I just ran through. And it might take 10-6 to make the playoffs because if you're looking at the standings right now, I think it's safe to assume Baltimore is going to be in as the 5 seed. They're the best second place team in the league right now, or in the AFC anyway. That would leave Las Vegas, the Dolphins, the Browns, and the Colts fighting. That's four teams fighting for two spots. All four of those teams right now are 5-3. So it's kind of that's going to be a fight, I think. And you know, the Browns have got their work cut out for them here. I mean, it's great. They're going to have some meaningful games here down the stretch. And, you know, they've got a great opportunity in front of them. But losing that Raiders game a week and a half ago, I think really cut their margin for error in the second half of the season down significantly.
Yeah, it definitely did. I think the way I look at it is, and maybe this turns out to be a mistake, but in my mind, 10 wins has always generally gotten you in the playoffs unless you were the Browns in 07? 07? Right. Okay, that's what, yeah.
How fitting would it be, by the way, if they finally get back to 10 wins again this year
and then miss it again?
That they expand the playoffs by a team and they still miss anyway. That would be peak Browns.
I think that's probably where, and this might be mistaken logic on my part, 10's always basically been good to get you in. So I assumed, I guess in my head, I'm thinking if they expand it, then maybe then 9 should be good to get you in this year. But obviously, that might not end up being the case. I don't know. But I guess I look at the schedule and I see, you know, if they're going to get to 9, you have to assume that both the New York games are wins, right? Jacksonville should definitely be a win. So that's 3 and they're at 8.
Those are all 3 road games. Now, I don't know if home field advantage doesn't really mean as much, but, you know,
there's always the travel and the comfort level outside of just the crowd noise. So there are other things that go into it, but still have to expect that those, you know, they're considerably better. And right, as I say that right now, I'm watching the Jets kind of stick it to the Patriots here.
Sticking it.
sticking it to them. Yeah, I turned this on and the game was 20-10. I'm like, what the hell's going on? It's 2017 now, but still, Joe Flacco looking real elite tonight. But yeah, so I guess in my head, I'm thinking maybe, and maybe this is optimistic and I shouldn't take this for granted, but they take one of these games against a team that's better than them, right? Tennessee, Pittsburgh, or Baltimore. If they can steal one of those games, it puts them in a pretty damn good spot. So,
right.
I don't know. It's yeah, maybe I'm taking a little bit for granted. Usually you assume if a team starts 5-2, then they're in a pretty good spot, but who knows? We'll see. Yeah, you're right though. I think if you're really going to like sort of bank on it and be somewhat comfortable, they probably had to win that game against the Raiders.
Yeah. All right. One other Browns thing I wanted to bring up last week with the bye, the Athletic did a deep dive on the 25-year anniversary of the old Browns announcing their move.
Yeah. Was that commissioned by Modell's family? They somehow managed to turn him into a hell of a sympathetic figure.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I know you're a couple years younger than me. How much of that whole ordeal do you remember?
Oh, I mean, remember firsthand from when it first happened? I mean, I've read about it a lot since then, but when it happened, very little.
Okay. Have I told my story from that time period on here?
I don't know, but I think you're gonna.
Might as well. So that move was announced in the middle of a week, and that following weekend, the Browns had a home game against the Oilers, and at the halftime of that game, they were going to be honoring all of the finalists in the area punt, pass, and kick competition. And my cousin had made the finals, so he was going to get to be on the field at halftime. So my mom said, hey, you know, your cousin's going to be on the field at the stadium during the Browns game. You know, let's go down there and check it out. This will be a lot of fun. So we got tickets, and then all hell breaks loose with this. So we're like, all right, well, we're still going to go down there and we'll see how it goes. As we are driving on the freeway, I can remember exactly where I was. We were on Route 44 making that merge onto Route 2 West. And on the radio, we had the pregame, and we heard that there was a bomb threat called in on Cleveland Municipal Stadium. And I gave my mom a look like, hey, are you sure we should be going down there? She's like, ah, it'll be fine. You know, we'll be okay. Don't worry about it. And obviously, there was no actual bomb at the stadium that day. But
that you know of.
That I know of.
Didn't go off.
That was the one good thing that day. Otherwise, though, we were sitting down in the lower bowl, kind of pretty far up along the first base side. And if you remember, we were like right behind the first base dugout. And if you remember that for the Browns to take the field, they would have to run out of the dugout because that was obviously what led to the locker rooms at the old stadium. And just a bizarre, angry, bitter, enraged, every adjective you could think of, atmosphere down there. All the local advertisers who had signage in the stadium had pulled their deals and wanted nothing to do with the Browns. So like all of the ads on the scoreboard and on the facades of the second deck and in the concourses were all either painted over with spray paint or turned backwards and upside down, trying to cover everything as quickly as they could. And as you might know, people who go to Browns games tend to consume some alcohol.
Been known to happen.
It has been known to happen. So there were quite a few guys. I can remember a few of them in hunting suits, specifically drunkenly staggering down the stairs as the team ran off the field at halftime. And these guys almost bum rushed the dugout. To just screaming obscenities at the players and the coaches as if this was their fault, which obviously I don't think they really had.
That's an interesting approach.
It was rough. And to cap the thing, the whole deal off, the Browns obviously did not play very well that day. They got beat, and the actual punt, pass, and kick competition was held before the game, long before the players were out on the field warming up that morning. My cousin, he did not place in the finals, but he did get to go on the field at halftime. Thankfully, he was not rushed by any of the lunatics in the stands. But just a banner afternoon all around down on the lakefront.
Was there anything from that article that like stood out to you as it seems like the Al Lerner angle is relatively new to most? I think there was always sort of like rumblings about it because obviously he was obviously very involved with the move too. So it shouldn't be terribly surprising what sort of took place there. But the thing that stood out to me from the article was I can't remember who it was, but there was someone in the league office when he first found out, he was talking to Modell and Modell told him that he was moving the team, was like, no, come back in here. We can do something about this. And Modell was pretty much defeated at that point, it sounds like. And he'd, you know, sort of conceded, no, it's over. But that if Art was, you know, maybe a little more level headed at the time, he could have still saved it. And it sounds like it wasn't beyond reproach at that point.
Yeah, you know, I knew Al Lerner had been involved in all of that, but I don't think I realized the extent or specifically what his role was. I don't remember. I think it was the sidebar, the secondary piece that The Athletic published that had some additional deals or details on the deal that the city tried to offer the Browns with building a new stadium down like a little bit south of where Gateway is, which I don't think I had ever known about. And it was really strange. Like it was right by the freeway and the traffic. They were really concerned about the traffic noise, which if you've got 70,000 people in a stadium, I mean, like you're not going to really hear traffic.
Also, if you've driven on the freeway during a Browns game in Cleveland.
Right.
Not that much going on.
Right, exactly. There's that too. It was a very strange, but they were going to like build the stadium like three quarters of the stadium was going to be underground. It was a really, and kind of shoehorned in this, one of the train companies has property down there that they were going to try to put the stadium there. So I didn't really know any of that. I had heard there had been talk about making Progressive Field, or what, you know, was first Jacobs Field when it opened, a multi-purpose stadium, and having the Browns and Indians play there. And I would love to see what the sketches would have looked like and what they, you know, I guess in the one end by Eagle Avenue, it would have, you know, extended out further than, you know, what the actual baseball stadium looks like now. I would love to know what a multi-purpose stadium would have looked like at that point, because that was right around that time where the whole era of multi-sport stadiums was pretty much coming to an end. I mean, yeah. I can't think of any that have opened since then. So,
and that was a big part of, I mean, that took a, when the Indians were getting a new stadium, that took a bit of a bite out of Modell's revenue too. So it wasn't like,
sure.
It wasn't like that would have, you know, fixed all that ailed the Browns at the time. Now, obviously, a new stadium would have been nice. But, yeah, I think that was also getting into – that was right around the time that the Indians were in the playoffs every year. So that would have been a lot of – and I'll be honest, I've railed on this before on this, but, like, where the Raiders were playing before with a goddamn infield in the middle of a football field was just ridiculous. And if we had that for Browns games, I don't know. I'm glad they didn't go with that, I guess, all things considered. But
yeah, you know, this is the first year in NFL history that they have no teams playing in a stadium that is shared with a baseball team.
Because Oakland moved?
Yes.
Because, well,
they were the last one.
Who was like the last one before them? I feel like they were sort of the only one for quite some time.
Well,
I don't know if you know off the top of your head, obviously not, but
I mean, I
know
that
it'd been quite some time, right?
The Chargers were playing in Qualcomm, but Petco had been built for the Padres. So for the last few years for the Chargers in San Diego, they were football only. I'm trying to think what else would have been a shared football baseball stadium. I mean, you obviously had the Marlins and the Dolphins at whatever they're calling that stadium this week down in Miami. Yeah, it's that concept was a dying breed.
Thank goodness.
I'll tell you, it was probably, 15, almost 20 years ago now when I was playing Madden, I want to say on like the PS2. And if you were playing season mode on there, the first few weeks of the season, if you were playing in one of those multi-purpose stadiums, they would have the dirt infield on the field. And I thought that was like the most mind-blowing technology ever, that like they could even get a detail like that into these games.
Did it impact anything in the game?
Not as far as I know.
Were you like a fraction of a second slower or something?
Not as far as I know.
That would have been something.
It should have made you like shank all your kicks or something if you were on the infield.
Dirt. Yeah, every time you step in that, you just trip and fall.
Right. Yeah, but I always thought that was fun. So, yeah, anyway, it's 25 years it's been since the Browns move.
That's wild. And that was a good read, I'll admit. I enjoyed, sort of looking through it and sort of seeing more of the behind-the-scenes stuff that happened. It doesn't change my opinion of Modell a whole lot, even though it does. I think it paints him in a much more sympathetic light. But, and sort of like you said, I don't remember much of what was happening at the time anyways. So I wasn't very in tune with it. I knew the Browns left, and like, I remember being people being pissed off about it and all that stuff, but I wasn't watching the news to see sort of why it all came to that and all that stuff. So I sort of learned it secondhand later on. And just generally, I don't know. It's he's a guy that he's obviously never going to sort of be liked in Cleveland at all, right? But it's one of those things that every once in a while seems to come up around Hall of Fame time. Like, is it time to forgive Art Modell? And this feels like one of those articles that would have come out around that time to sort of prop him up but try to get him into the Hall of Fame.
Mm. One much lighter note from that, Leon Bibb, the Channel 3 anchor,
yeah.
He about like, I don't know, around week two or three of this season, did a story that I guess in 95, right around the time that the team announced they were moving and there were all those negotiations going on for trying to get a new team, all the merchandise at the local department stores, sporting goods stores, yada, yada, was basically marked on clearance because we were not going to have a Browns team anymore. And he bought a Browns starter pullover. Mike White, the mayor of Cleveland at the time, said, buy the jacket. We're getting the team. I'm telling you right now, we're getting the team. We're going to keep our name and our colors. Buy that jacket. You're going to need it. So he did. And then, Browns came back 99, beginning of the season. It became very clear very quickly that team was awful. And Leon kept that jacket in the closet, tag still on, and was like, and he said, I'm not putting this thing on. I'm not breaking it out until we got a team that's worth putting it on for. And finally this year, when the Browns got off to their great start, he said, you know what? It's time. And he brought the jacket.
Really? So he didn't do it for the 10-win season, huh?
No, he did not. But all this right. Year, he said, you know what? It's time. I'm pulling out my Brown starter pullover. And it's mint condition. Look good. Leon Bibb nice. Was...
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. I'd love to know what he could have flipped that for on eBay. But, you can't put a price on sentimental value.
You really can't. Yeah, Bibb, he's been doing it forever. He's got more money than God. He doesn't need it.
It's a Cleveland institution right there.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Made man.
Definitely.
Pit Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on!
Let's talk Ohio State football. Let's talk college football. I will admit I've had a hard time getting into the season, although I did enjoy immensely the final couple minutes of regulation and overtime in that Notre Dame-Clemson game the other night. But we finally have Buckeyes football. What do I need to know here? Seems like Ohio State's in a great position to be making the playoff. And the Big Ten, other than Ohio State, looks like a royal mess right now.
You say that, and on paper maybe, but if this was, if you looked at this and changed all of the names of the teams in the Big Ten to SEC teams, we'd just be talking about how the conference is so deep, and that's why no one has that good of a record. Mm. But truthfully, yeah, it's not really that good. I think Penn State came in with high expectations, and they were eight coming into the season, and then I personally think they got screwed against Indiana. I think that 2-point conversion was no good, but that's sort of, you know, it shouldn't have been that close against Indiana in the first place. Ohio State's really standing out, and this is not a new development, right? This happens every year. So yeah, Ohio State is far and away the best team in the league by a pretty decent margin. The thing that's a little different is that's been, you know, the norm for the last decade, right? They've always had more talent on the field than anyone else in the league, and they've had the best coaching in the league. So they've, you know, pretty much run roughshod over the Big Ten. They look, in my opinion, different than they've looked through the Urban Meyer era and through last year. I think that they're a different looking team. Justin Fields is far and away the best quarterback Ohio State's ever had, by a pretty decent margin, I think. And this year, I think he is considerably better than last year. I think his second year in the system, he's just more comfortable with the offense. The offense is completely led by two stud wide receivers. Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave are both studs, right? They're both going to be, you know, first round picks really soon. And that's sort of the way that the offense goes. And even in the past, when we've had, you know, we had Michael Thomas, we've had these really good wide receivers and really good quarterbacks, but we still always relied for the most part on the run. Even when we had Dwayne Haskins putting up 5,000 yard season, still had a really heavy, really strong running game. And that was sort of the way that the offense went. We don't have J.K. Dobbins, Zeke Elliott, Carlos Hyde, any of those guys that we've been so used to having. We've had a really reliable, really good, overall, you know, probably top five, top seven running back in the country. We've had one of those consistently for the better part of the last decade, and we don't have that this year. The guys, both, they just don't, none of them really, no, the fact that at this point in the season, no one's really stood out as like the go-to running back should be a bit of a red flag to begin with. Mazdur Teague looks big, but like he looks great. He looks like a guy that, you know, you don't want to be trying to tackle, but if there's not an open hole, he's not real shifty. He can't, doesn't seem like he, you know, can turn on a dime and just, you know, change direction, all those sorts of things that we're used to. So the offense is going to look a lot different. On the defensive side, kind of the same thing, a little weird because they don't have a guy that just jumps off the screen to you. They don't have Chase Young or a Bosa or someone like that who you're like, that's the guy you have to double and triple team. I think expectations were that Zach Harrison might be that guy, but it might be a year early. He's really good, super talented guy. Was a top like five player in the country out of high school, but just hasn't really put it all together yet. He's had some moments and he's been solid, but he's not what Chase Young was. You know, he's not what Nick or Joey Bosa were. So it might be a little early for him. And it kind of showed on Sunday. Was a kind of a weird game. I don't know how much of it you got a chance to watch, but really sort of awkward. The first half was incredible. And then in the second half, Rutgers just mucked it up and threw every goofy, random trick play you could imagine at them. And literally all of them worked, which is not an encouraging sign. So it was sort of a frustrating game, but that's sort of what this team is. They're going to be the most talented team on the field every time they play by a decent margin until we get to the playoff. And given what we've seen from, it's kind of a weird thing. Given what we've seen from everyone in the Big Ten so far, Indiana's probably the toughest team on their schedule. At least that's what it seems like right now.
Yeah. To answer your question about how much of the game I saw on Saturday night, I will tell you this. I was over at my sister's house. They had a bonfire set up in the fire pit in their driveway. They got out one of those big projector screens and had some family over there for her birthday. So I was kind of watching the game, and I had made a bet with my dad. A $1 bet, more for bragging rights than anything else. And I gave him Rutgers and 37 and a half points. And I talked a lot of shit through the first two quarters.
It was looking real good through the first 30
minutes. It was 35-3 at halftime, and I went home, and now I owe him a dollar. So
fast forward, spoiler.
Yeah, now yada, 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 I owe him four quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I saw what I needed to see and kind of skipped past the part that I would have rather not watched. So
like I said, it was a weird game. And you could tell, I was texting, I have two of my best friends I went to school with. We just constantly text during games about what's going on and what we're seeing. And constantly we're like, okay, one more series and then get Fields out of there. And then Rutgers would score. And it's like, fuck, well, now you have to leave him in still. Yeah. Never got to that point where they could pull him. And, you know, you're up 35-3 at halftime. Your starters should not see the end of that game. And they just couldn't figure it out. And so it was pretty frustrating. And it's like I said, you look at, I think they announced like the players of the game and whatnot, and the player of the week was Tough Borland on the offensive side. And I remember watching, and he was fine, he was okay, but no one was that good. I think we've been somewhat spoiled, and it might be a defense that kind of needs to figure out its identity, because, you know, you look last year. You had Chase Young, so quarterbacks didn't have any time to get rid of the ball. And you had Jeff Okuda, so they didn't have that many guys they could throw to. Sean Wade, I think expectation was he was going to fill in and be that guy. He's honestly been really – and he kind of got beat up a little bit in the Penn State game and gave up one big play last week. But if you watch that Penn State game, he's getting kind of – he was playing the guy pretty well, and the guy made a couple circus catches that, you know, ended up making Sean Wade look bad, but ultimately weren't really that bad of a play on his part. But he's not Jeff Okuda. He's not Denzel Ward. He's not Damon Arnett. He's not at least he doesn't seem that way right now. It's a young team. It's not, they don't have, you know, the stud at every, I mean, every year you can look at Ohio State and say they got a first round pick at defensive end, first round pick at cornerback, a couple really good linebackers that are going to be playing on Sundays. I don't know if they have the linebackers that are going to be playing in the NFL. And the defensive end just doesn't have those guys that are just studs yet. They've got a lot of talent, but a lot of inexperience. So it's a position we haven't been in before. We're still as talented as anyone. And being in the Big Ten this year is probably a bit of a luxury because they have time to figure it out. But right now it's sort of frustrating to watch. I'll say this, enjoy Justin Fields, because it's freakish how good he is. I think as of this week, he's responsible for more touchdowns than he is in completions, which is pretty good. Pretty good.
Is Tough Borland on that JT Barrett 7-year plan?
Seems like it, doesn't it?
I feel like I've been hearing that guy's name forever.
It seems like, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't. I think I always sort of mix, and we had Justin Boren. What was the middle? Zach Boren, Jacoby Boren, Tough Borland, like all of those guys in like succession from one another for like 11 years.
They coached by Al Borland from.
Yeah. 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 It, what was, I don't even remember what the high school was, but anyway, it's an interesting time. It's fun because, I mean, the passing game's insane. Justin Fields, I'll be honest, I texted somebody during the game the other day. I said, I understand that Trevor Lawrence is a lock for number one. Somebody is incredibly lucky that Trevor Lawrence is in this draft, because they're going to get Justin Fields.
Yeah.
I don't know who it's going to be, but I'll be honest, no one's even really talking about the idea that someone could pass Trevor Lawrence, but I don't know that I've ever seen a guy look this sharp and comfortable and competent He does everything well. And the thing that sort of stands out to me the most is he doesn't look like he's trying that hard.
Yeah.
There's times where he'll just sort of step back there and look around a little bit. And he's not panicking. Remember Peyton Manning always had sort of the happy feet and he'd sort of be like bouncing. And a lot of guys do that. He's sort of just standing there surveying everything very calm. And then he just rips one 50 yards down the field. And it's,
oh my God, that week one game that their Ohio State opener, when he had that like 45 yard post pattern, hit the guy right at the goal line in stride. I was just like, ooh, baby, that's nice.
he had another one this week where he threw it. I don't know how long it was, but it was right to the back of the end zone. And it was Garrett Wilson. He just put his hands up like this and just hit him right on the hands. And we've had good quarterbacks, none that were really like, huge NFL prospects, but we've had very productive, good quarterbacks. But look at JT Barrett, Cardale, Braxton Miller. Braxton Miller was obviously the whole offense, but he was a running quarterback. That was his threat. He wasn't super accurate. None of these guys have been super accurate. Dwayne Haskins had a huge year, but even then, they always had they were always able to sort of be dominant or sort of be very effective because we had a really good running back that just terrified the other defense, right? And they had to load the box up and they couldn't really blitz their asses off. They can blitz their asses off this year, and it's still not going to make a difference, it doesn't seem like.
Early projection for the playoff. I assume we are looking in some order at Ohio State, Alabama, Notre Dame, and Clemson.
Notre Dame, Clemson, and Florida are going to sort of battle it out, I think. It'll be interesting to see what happens at the end of the year, right? Because I think it'll sort of raise the question that if Notre Dame plays Clemson again and Notre Dame loses, do they still stay in the playoff? Because that'll be the last game of the year. It's tough to get in the playoff if you lose your last game. I don't know how many teams have ever done it. But that would also be the same thing with Florida, most likely, because if they win out and they go to the SEC championship game and lose to Bama, they still get in. I don't know. Right now, it seems like those are the only five that have a chance, honestly.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to ask you. Is there any chance for one of those other teams in like the group of five, like
Cincinnati or BYU, both have a chance? Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to think they both have a chance because of the weird season, right? There's only so many games. Like, it's weird. You look at it, and Ohio State only got one number one vote this week, which isn't. It's not a travesty or anything, but you'd think the way they're playing. But they've only played three games, and they're going against teams that have played 6 and 7. So it's just a weird season. So I don't know. Cincinnati seems like they're playing really, really well. Does anyone really think they're one of the four best teams in the country, though? That's going to be a tough sell.
Yeah. I was kind of laughing because I said, one of the nice things about this strange season is it completely messed up Notre Dame's schedule. So to like fill out their schedule, they had to go join a conference for the year and they joined the ACC. And I was like, okay, this is good. They're going to go get rinsed by Clemson. And we don't have to worry about them taking up a playoff spot. They're going to be out of the equation. And then Trevor Lawrence ends up having to miss a couple games and Notre Dame beats them. And now they're still in the conversation anyway. And
it's nuts. It's crazy. But I'll tell you what's going to, and I said this on Saturday, what's going to derail Notre Dame season is that super spreader event they had on the field after the game.
Yeah, boy, that's a tough look.
Bad look. Really bad look. I watched the game and I realized that there were fans there. I didn't realize there were that many fans in the stadium.
That's been one of these things that's been really strange to me watching the games in other conferences, like the Big Ten. It's what, just like a few family members for players?
Yeah, like no, yeah, not really.
No bands, no. A
couple hundred people, probably tops.
British Buckeye is social distancing this year.
Yeah, like they showed Fields' dad was at the game with, I think his, I'm not sure if it was mom or sister, but she was wearing a mask, so I don't know.
Right, but like some of these other conferences are letting in, 10,000, 15,000.
If you watched a Clemson game early in the season, I don't know if you'd even realize that it wasn't full capacity.
Yeah,
they were spaced out some, but they're right on top of each other.
There was a game at Georgia that was in primetime a few weeks ago. And who was that? Who were they playing against?
It wasn't Florida this week, was it?
No. This was like late September. It was like the first really interesting college football game of the year. And it looked from like field level like there was a ton of people there, but then they showed it from the blimp angle, and it's looking down, you're like, okay, that's not so bad. All of the stands, I mean, they've got people very specifically lined up and just enough space between them. I'm like, okay, that's probably pushing it, but you're for the most part okay. With the exception of the student section there, which looked like a complete free-for-all. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, man, that's another one. I'm getting nervous watching this, but, you know.
Like, you look, I mean, the season at any given moment is hanging by a thread, right? Like, Wisconsin already is one game away from not qualifying for the postseason.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So they're back this weekend.
Yeah.
But they've had to miss, two games?
Yeah, they're back. You got to feel like they're only back because they know they have to come back now. Like, do we really feel comfortable that they have a firm grasp on it? I don't. So who knows? I mean, it's all crazy. It's just, you don't know what's going on. You don't know at any given moment, anything crazy could happen. And all of a sudden your team misses a game or two and you guys are shit out of luck. So yeah. I don't know. And I'll be honest. I keep thinking that's the biggest thing that can hurt Ohio State at this point. And sure. It's weird watching it. Even if you're a Clemson fan, I think you're fine with last weekend. You know that if you win out, you're still in, which is weird because they're in the ACC and the ACC is awful. Usually a loss like that should be somewhat disqualifying. I mean, but they're going to get the benefit of the doubt because Lawrence wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Well, he was there. He was standing on the sideline, which is fucking insane. If you're suspended for COVID, but you're still standing on the sideline.
Yeah, my dad brought that up because he's been kind of frustrated with a lot of this. He's like, so you won't let him play, but it's okay for him to be on the sideline high-fiving teammates. How do you explain that? Because I've been, you know, I'm much more on the cautious end of this than he has in a lot of the conversations we've had. And I'm like, honestly, I have no good rationale for that.
Right. And
absolutely not.
It's bizarre how different everyone's sort of all these different groups are approaching it and what they're sort of like what they're, you know, I don't want to say penalties, but and I'm blanking on a guy. Oh, there's a linebacker for Ohio State whose name escapes me at the moment. And that sucks because that shouldn't happen. But he tested positive on one test. His second test tested negative. So it looks like it was a false positive on his first one, but he wasn't able to play, but he was able to be with the team. What is going on here? Like, why is he not allowed to play then? Like, if you're saying he's allowed to be near the team because that test was negative, then you're saying he doesn't have it, so he's safe to be around. Okay, then why can't he play? Makes no sense. It's the inconsistency on that front. And I think everyone was in such a hurry to, you know, play football again that they didn't really think about how to do it. And it seems like they all sort of consulted different people who had different approaches and different opinions, and somehow they haven't reached any sort of consensus on the best way to do it is. But yeah, your dad and I'm pretty sure are at opposite ends of the spectrum on how to approach this. And we can both look at that and agree that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Well, we didn't even mention in the 30 plus minutes that we talked about the Browns that, you know, Baker's on that COVID restricted list. I think as far as I know that
it seems like it's just because of contact,
but it was in contact with the staff member who had gotten it. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's a wrinkle for them, but yeah, at all levels of football, I know it also affected one of the high school teams this past weekend in one of the playoff games around here. So yeah, I mean, it's just part of the football landscape for this year, hopefully just this year. Got some good news about some progress from the vaccine world. Pfizer, I think it was, that had some good news today. So let's all keep our fingers crossed that things start going in that direction, keep making progress there.
Yeah, and the other thing, just final note, sort of put a bow on, the thing that's kind of crazy about the Big Ten's approach is you have to play at least six games to qualify for the postseason. Wisconsin forfeited two. They've had two games canceled because they weren't able to play and they didn't, you know, they sort of didn't have a handle on it. And so that cost them two games, but that also cost two other teams, cost Nebraska and I can't remember who they were supposed to play a week ago. But it cost those teams games too, by no fault of their own. Nebraska right. didn't have guys suspended. So, but they still count that as a no contest. It's not a loss. It's a no contest.
So, if, like, so one of those teams would have to like go.
If two other teams that Nebraska is playing have to cancel games, Nebraska is out of the postseason by no fault of their own, which is right. sort of a bizarre approach, but what are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. It's strange days. All right. Last thing I wanted to bring up, we lost a legend yesterday. The passing of Alex Trebek, the Jeopardy host. You know, we don't really get into game shows much on here, but one of the most beloved figures on television. I know you are a big Jeopardy guy. You were the first person I thought of when I saw that news yesterday afternoon. You and I texted about it a little bit. You want to say a few words?
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't have been shocking, but it still was. I mean, he's a guy who I can remember, like, various stages of my life, Alex Trebek being involved. When I was a little kid, I would go to my grandma's house and we would watch Jeopardy. And it was interesting because I was very young and my grandma wasn't exactly like a trivia master. So she wasn't like, neither one of us was like great at Jeopardy. But we still liked Alex Trebek. We still enjoyed the show, right? He made the show. You didn't have to be like a genius to enjoy a game that quite generally is pretty tough. Jeopardy's tough for most people, right? It's not an easy game show to watch. It's not one where you sit on a rally through, but he made it enjoyable. And fast forward, you know, 30 years, one of the favorite things that it's really the only like ongoing tradition in our house is my wife and I like to watch Jeopardy while we eat dinner. We'll DVR it and watch, you know, from previous days or whatever it is. And we both just enjoy watching it. And Alex Trebek is a big part of that. So it's, I don't know what the path forward is going to be, if they're going to keep the show or what they're going to do, but in the world of game shows, I feel like Alex Trebek kind of stands pretty much all by himself at the top of the list. Obviously Barker's up there, but yeah, it's just, it's a real, I don't know. It sucks. And it takes a lot of wind out of sails of some things that have been happening recently that I was quite happy about. So it was just one of those sort of deflating things that happened on Sunday. And I don't know, it sucks. And it's one of there's not many people in any walk of life, really, that when they die, you see universal love yeah. for. Right, you didn't see anyone at all being like, "Eh, I didn't really like Jeopardy. I don't really care for Trebek." Everybody loved the guy, even if you weren't that good at Jeopardy and you didn't watch Jeopardy all the time. You look at Alex Trebek and you say, "Yeah, that's a pretty good guy." And so it just sucks. It's a brutal loss, but I don't know. I was sort of encouraged to hear that, you know, he sort of, it sounds like from his family that he sort of knew that it was coming, and he decided earlier this weekend he just wanted to hang out at home with his wife and relax, and that's what he did and went out on his own terms. So good for him.
Yeah, I mean, somebody that's the host of Jeopardy, and you know, and he had hosted other game shows before that as well. You know, to be in the, I mean, he did Jeopardy for 36 years, and I don't think there was ever an Alex Trebek scandal of any kind. I mean, that guy is clean as a whistle. And you know, to your point, like you were saying, just universally loved. And you know, it's Jeopardy is one of those shows I don't think I ever watched it nearly as religiously as you did. I would check it out from time to time. But what was strange was, you know, over the summer, they kind of got into that period where they didn't have any new episodes because all the production got shut down because of COVID. So they started digging into the vault, and I started watching some of those, and it was kind of cool to see like his first ever episode from 1984 or whatever it was, or like the first time they had a champion run through 5 straight days. And then some of the other, you know, big, you know, notable episodes from over the years. And then when they finally got back to taping, I was like, okay, how much different is this really going to look? I curiosity got me. I was like, I want to see what Jeopardy looks like now. How much are they? Because like, I don't. I'm like, this feels like the kind of show that they should be able to pull off pretty seamlessly. And really, for the most part, you know, if you've been watching the last 6 weeks or so, the podiums are further apart, and Alex Trebek doesn't walk over to the contestants. He kind of keeps like 15, 20 feet away. And other than that, you would have no idea anything was different from
the past. Assume there's no audience too.
Yeah. So, but like watching that, I was like, hey, you know, this is really fun. I don't know why I haven't been watching this show more. And I've like, all of a sudden in the last 6 weeks or so, I've started watching Jeopardy like every single night. It was like, I got hooked on it just in time to like really feel the full effect of a gut punch of Alex Trebek passing away. So it was kind of like, oh man, that sucks. I mean, I know he had been, you know, battling cancer for a while here.
Still doesn't, yeah, it doesn't make it any better.
No. And
one thing that I always thought was sort of funny about him, and one of the sort of qualities that he had, was when he was like, he was very smart himself. He wasn't just a good game show host. He knew, like, he knew background on all the things that he was very smart. He had a lot of this knowledge himself, obviously, from hosting the show and just, I think, his own sort of reading and life experiences, whatnot. But I always thought that he sort of had a knack for making the people sort of like poking fun at the people that were on the show if they like got one wrong or mispronounced a word or whatever it was. And like almost making them not feel stupid, not making them feel bad, but like poking fun at them. But if you're sitting at home and you did the same thing yourself, you didn't feel like he was attacking you too. So it was like you as the listener at home or the viewer at home and Alex Trebek were sort of doing it together. And he's like, yeah, I'm with these people. And that's just sort of the feeling I got from it. I never felt like, you know, I always felt like he was just this guy that if you sat down and talked to him, he'd know he's smarter than most of you.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't make you feel like it.
Yeah. He had a perfect way of expressing exactly what you just said, where, you know, I'm trying to think how I want to say this. Like there was a great clip that was making the rounds yesterday of when they had contestants on, nobody watched football, and all five clues were something NFL related.
And none of them got it.
No, they just went like 0-for-5, and he's just kind of like, you know, breaking the fourth wall, looking at the camera. And then by the, the highest dollar value clue comes up, and it was something about the purple people eaters defense from the Minnesota Vikings. And as soon as he got done reading it, he goes, if any of you get this, I'm going to die.
And that was, and he just seemed like, he seemed like an everyman, but he was also just, I don't know, it just seems like every account of him is that he was a great dude.
There's something about, you know, that genre of television that is just overly polite, and everybody is, you know, always rooting for everybody, and we want to see a win, and you know, that's nice. But he kind of has just, I never picked this up until I started watching every day in the last month and a half, where, like, if you are a returning champion and you missed Final Jeopardy the day before and somehow managed to live to tell the tale, you should almost show up the next day with like a note of apology for still being there. He kind of, you know, but the flip side of that, and I think this is what you told me, and you know, when we were texting about this yesterday, was when there was like a really great game, or, you know, a contestant like the one I was watching earlier tonight, the guy ended up winning with $44,000. Spoiler alert if you're DVRing it, anyone. You know, when he praises those guys that or ladies, or, you know, any of the contestants that really turned in an awesome performance, you know it's earned. And that's really cool.
Yeah, and I think in recent years, like the with James Holzhauer, the guy who was just a machine, right? And completely changed the way that, you know, played the game completely against sort of conventional wisdom, never played it safe, like always went all in. I think at first Alex was like, you know, what is this fucking guy doing? And then quickly realized, like, he knows that he knows most of the answers and he's comfortable with it. And if there's one thing, you know, Alex respected, it was people that were really good at the game. So, you know, ultimately he turned into, you know, he'd be referencing James all the time and just out of nowhere for some random reason, right? But he really did appreciate people who were just like brilliantly I don't even want to say smart, because it's not always, I don't think it's purely an intelligence thing. It's more of a knowledge game, but the two sort of go hand in hand. But he appreciated the people that were just incredible at the game, no matter how they did it. And you know, respected them a lot, because he'd seen so many people come through that even people who were brilliantly intelligent and knew all these things didn't dominate the way that some of these, a handful of these people did, right? There's Ken Jennings, there's Brad, and there's James, and they're kind of in sort of a tier of their own. And yeah, he'd been doing it for so long that he really appreciated people that were just excellent at the game. And he sort of calmed down, I think, and didn't care as much. You could see there were some early on, you know, years within the last few years, people that would sort of bounce all over the board and just change the way that they played the game. It sort of bugged him at first. And I think he sort of came to appreciate a little bit more that these people are just figuring out a different way to play it. Just because people were playing it the same for 25, 30 years doesn't mean they were playing it the right way.
Yeah. Well, we got the tribute at the top of the episode tonight from the executive producer, which, by the way, he was, I forgot he's the producer of Jeopardy now, because he was with The Price is Right forever. I'm a big Price is Right guy. So I was like, oh my God, what is he doing? Oh, right. Now he works for Jeopardy. You know, there was also the, you know, they and explained that, I don't know if it was mentioned on TV, but the plan is that they're going to air the rest of the episodes that Alex
last Trebek one, I think, is on Christmas, right?
Recorded through the end of the year. And the last one will be on Christmas night. And I said, boy, if that isn't just the perfect way to sum up this year, this no godforsaken kidding. Year that we've had, getting the last ever episode of Jeopardy with Alex Trebek that we're ever going to get to close out Christmas night. Just, boy, that's a little on the nose.
That's going to be brutal. Yeah, it's going to be rough to watch. I don't know. I think for a lot of people, even, I mean, you're not, like you admitted, not huge Jeopardy guy. You liked it, but didn't watch it like religiously. That's still going to be a tough watch, I think, for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
If you had to bet, are they going to replace him? Are they going to retire the show and start something new? What do you think?
Well, they're definitely not going to start something new. Way too much money in Jeopardy in its current format.
Are we so sure that they couldn't just, you know, replace it with another trivia style game that's different styled? And
I think there's too much brand equity in the Jeopardy name that they would at least try it with somebody else. I don't feel qualified to be making a guess, but I'm going to anyway. If you asked me to take a guess as to who's going to replace him, it would be Ken Jennings, especially because they just brought him on to in a advisory capacity. Yeah. And they tonight, again, spoiler if anybody hasn't seen it yet, he reads clues for one of the categories, which is not the first time he's done that. And I think the last time he did it, Trebek even kind of made a joke like, man, this guy might replace me or something like that. I better look out.
He's also got, I mean, if you notice, if you follow him on Twitter stuff, he's a pretty witty guy. He's pretty funny. He's, you know,
Ken Jennings
is
a good follow on
him,
Twitter.
So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he'd be a good fill-in. I do know that, like, a few years ago when they asked him, when they talked to Trebek, he said he would like his replacement to be a woman. But
Betty White, right? That was what I read in the interviews. He kept saying Betty White.
I think he sort of threw that name out there, sort of.
He stuck by it, though. That's his stock answer in, like, every interview that he does. So, yeah.
I don't know that she wants that, and I don't know if they want to be replacing the next host again in, like, 2 years. But, sorry, that's bad karma. They don't want to replace her, you know, whenever her time comes.
Right.
But, yeah, Ken Jennings, he just seems like the natural fit. If you're going to look at people who are – there's no one outside of Trebek, he's pretty easily the most identifiable person with that show.
Yeah. Yeah. So if they're going to try it with anybody, that seems to be as safe a direction as they could possibly go. So we'll see. They got some time to figure it out, I guess.
Yeah, but that's going to be a rough watch on Christmas night. I'll say that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, bud. Well, what do you say? I think
wrap it up.
Yeah, we've gone over an hour here. So, yeah, as a reminder, as always, you can subscribe to The Nail in the Coffin on Apple Podcasts. We are on Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, waitingfornextyear.com. You can always stream us on there. Go check out our archives as well on thenailpodcast.com. I might be popping up in some other places here sooner than later. Details to follow. But that's going to do it for us for this week. So for Trev Shuley, I'm Tom Valentino. It's been The Nail in the Coffin. Talk to you again soon.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.